Liberty Watch is a program that is paid for, and hosted, and board-opt, and owned, wholly owned by Charles Heller, and the opinions are strictly my own, not necessarily those of the radio station. And Liberty Watch is a program based in objective reality and biased towards individual liberty. And as such, it operates outside the bounds of political correctness. And we have the joy and pleasure of having with us Lori Cihas. Am I saying it correctly?
Lauren Cihas, yes.
Lauren Cihas, thank you for that's a great, that's an auspicious way to start out. And Lauren, and she is with the Liberty Justice Center, and they are partnering with the Pelican Institute on a fascinating lawsuit. And it is, it's the type of thing that is just made for coverage by Liberty Watch. And on foundation, Lauren, what drives you to public interest law?
Well, could I give you a little bit of background about me? I was in private practice for a number of years, and it was actually the pandemic that really kind of motivated me to really get involved in constitutional law and defending freedoms. I felt, compelled during the COVID pandemic, when there was a lot of government lockdowns and infringements on, right to travel and discrimination against people because of their vaccination status. And all of those things really made my practice area in private practice feel meaningless. Hmm. While I did have important aspects to defend clients in their various matters, which were very important to them personally, but I felt like I could be doing so much more for the state that I lived in and the country by just fighting for these freedoms, because what good is my law degree if I can't defend the Constitution?
Wow. Why does more of the law, not to go down a tangent here, but why does more of the law profession not sound like that?
It's an excellent question, and I don't think there's going to be one answer for that. I think there's so many factors that go into play. For me, I think it was just meant to be that I was supposed to transition away from private practice and focus primarily on constitutional law.
Well, your degree is in environmental law, isn't it?
Well, so I have a law degree, but I do have a certificate for environmental law.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah. Well,
you're a Juris Doctorate from the University of Hawaii, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. So does that take a lot more work to become certified in environment? In other words, this is like another year of study to become certified in practicing environmental law?
No. So within the 3 years of law school, and just about every law school is pretty standard practice. The first year of law school, you don't get to choose your classes. They're set for you, and they're the basic foundational pieces for law. And your second and third year, you get to choose your classes, and you have a wide variety of classes to choose from. You can choose classes that are going to help you to pass your bar exam, because there's 13 to 14 subjects that are tested on the bar exam. Or you can choose classes that are, more interesting to you. And I went with a kind of mixed plate. So I took some bar classes and some classes that were interesting. And so long as I met the criteria for the interesting classes and the other criteria for getting an environmental law certificate, it just means that I took a few more environmental law classes than, other people.
Yeah, it means you know how to spell NEPA. Anyway,
yes.
And you know how to fight with the knights who say NEPA. Anyway, I also see you have a lot of followers from the NRA. Is there a short story there?
From the NRA?
Yeah.
Yes. So recently we filed two cases in Nebraska. So Nebraska passed constitutional carry, and the law basically preempted any cities or counties from regulating firearms just about in every single way. So they couldn't possess, transport. They couldn't issue any regulations regarding firearms for a multitude of ways. The one way that the state left open in this constitutional carry was that they could still regulate the discharge of a weapon, which makes sense from a practical standpoint,
sure.
Crimes. So what happened was Lincoln and Omaha both decided to first issue executive orders by their mayors, basically prohibiting firearms in public places, primarily in parks. And there are many Nebraskans that openly carry, because it's actually lawful in Nebraska to openly carry, and a lot of them that have been concealed carry, and they have their permits. And so, you know, there's slight differences between Lincoln and Omaha, but the gist of it is that we brought two lawsuits in both cities challenging those executive orders, and then in Lincoln, they had some subsequent, I'm sorry, Omaha, they had some subsequent ordinances that tried to ban ghost guns and gun parts, essentially, or accessory parts, like accessory accelerators. And it was before the bump stock decision from the Supreme Court. So we challenged those.
Cargill.
And so, yes, we do have some NRA followers for defending the Second Amendment.
Uh-huh. And let's get on to it. What is the 1938 Natural Gas Act, and what does it allow government to do?
So the Natural Gas Act was established, as you said, in back in 1938, and the purpose of it was to regulate the exportation of natural gas. And in the language of the statute itself, Congress decided that not only was the regulation important, but it was important for the economy. And so in the statute, it presumes that the exportation is almost always going to be in the public's best interest. And therefore, the statute requires approval of, I'm going to say LNG, but it's liquid natural gas, so LNG export applications, unless the Department of Energy affirmatively finds that it would not be in the public's best interest. And so what that does is basically it allows the Department of Education, it allows the Department of Energy to evaluate LNG export applications on a case-by-case basis. So in other words, if they're like, hey, we want to export LNG to Iran, then the DOE can go, well, you know what? Things are a little bit hostile
right
now.
They don't need
it. We're going to say no.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we're going to send it to North Korea for use and for
yes.
use as an accelerant in their hydrogen bomb program. Yeah, and we're going to say no to that. Yeah.
Exactly. So it allows the DOE to have that little bit of discretion based on like geopolitical climate, you know, and who they're trying to export to. And that, you know, that seems like a good public interest, and it's written into the statute. So that's essentially what the Natural Gas Act does. And the DOE has been operating under this, you know, statute for, you know, and even, well, obviously for decades since 1938, but even in back in 1984, the DOE produced what they call the 1984 guidelines. And so those guidelines just reaffirmed this case-by-case
determination for application. If that isn't an apocryphal name.
Oh, I know, the 1984 guy. Yes. It included Big Brother cameras, too. Right. No, I'm joking.
And drones.
Yes, and drones. No, it didn't. So, but it does, the DOE has been operating under these guidelines for the past 40 years. So they've been doing this case by case, and they've been taking into consideration environmental aspects. You know, so there's actually been studies that the DOE actually produced, and the studies found that there was greater environmental like harm when they don't export to LNG, which seems, you know, contradictory to logic. But mm-hmm. what they were finding was that if they didn't export the LNG to these other countries, then the other countries were relying on energy that wasn't as clean as LNG.
Mm-hmm.
So they
like
were
coal.
Taken into yes, exactly. So, you know, environmental consideration has been in place for the past 40 years. You know, so that's really not a strong argument for the executive branch right now.
So what you're suggesting is that the federal government is exceeding its authority in suspending the export of LNG. Is that what the lawsuit is about?
Yeah, so that's the gist of it. So basically what happened, for those who don't know, in January of this year, the president announced, not by an official executive order, but just kind of like announced on the White House website. And in coordination, the DOE also announced, not by, you know, they don't have executive authority to issue an executive order, but they've also announced that they were going to, quote unquote, pause all LNG export applications. And the pause was set to be indefinitely. So it wasn't really a pause. It was a complete ban on all LNG export applications. You know, so no new applications were going to even be considered. And they said, well, we want to take into consideration environmental impacts. But what they've stated in other public places is that their objective is actually to get rid of LNG exports altogether.
Based on what?
Well, so the information that I saw was actually White House spokespersons talking about how they had just been at, I believe it was the UN, might have been the World Economic Forum, but I think it was the UN, so you know, not sure about that one, but I got to check my record. But after they went to this international convention, they basically were like, well, we decided that LNG exports need to cease, and so we're putting a pause on it. Now, that was not in the official statement that was on the official agency website. Those were other, like, news reports and quotes from White House spokespersons. So their intention is to cease all LNG exports, but that's what effectively happened back in January. So we brought suit shortly after a number of states. There were 16 states with attorney generals that filed a joint lawsuit against the Biden administration, the DOE, and every person in between that would have this authority. Huh. And basically, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm just going to tell you that it's fascinating. I want to discuss who this affects most greatly and on the other side of this break. And we'll be right back after, and we'll be right back in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios with Lauren Cihes of the Liberty Justice Center. And hopefully this is the right break. Yep, this is the right break. This is the right music. And we'll be right back with Lauren in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios. If you want to call in and ask about liquefied natural gas shipment and the government's actions thereon.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening to Liberty Watch with Charles Heller, Tucson, Arizona.
This is Herman Cain. You'd get some good bargains on the swap shop on AM 1030, KVOI, The Voice. And have Charles make fun of your stuff.
I click clack my bills, they have my fill. I'm a gigantic pelican. I fly all day, I bathe and play. In shallow waters, I plunge my neck in.
And welcome back to Liberty Watch. No, this is not turned into a children's show, but the guest is Lauren Cihes, and she's an attorney, and she's an attorney with the Liberty Justice Center, which is working with the Pelican Institute out of Louisiana on a lawsuit that really affects some of the people, the workers in Louisiana, on the federal government's basically ceasing the export permits for liquefied natural gas. And how badly has this caused an economic effect? Has this caused, Lauren?
Well, I don't think we have felt the full effect. You know, so LNG export applications, you know, they take time to put together, to get through the process, to get approved, and then once they're approved, and then of course it takes time for that liquid natural gas to start going out. So I don't think we have felt the full effects, and hopefully we won't feel those effects. Mm-hmm. Because an update to the case that, you know, of course, kind of why I'm here on the show today,
right, there's
is because
an injunction.
Of this development. Yes. So, like I said, back in January, DOE and the president announced they're pausing, and I say that in air quotes, pausing all LNG export applications. Well, a number of states filed suit. We filed shortly behind them to represent the interests of the actual workers, the oil and natural gas workers. And we did that for a specific strategic purpose that, you know, if there was any challenges to the standing of the states to bring these claims, then hopefully those interests would be represented by the actual workers who would be put out of employment if there is no LNG exports. So,
pardon my interruption, but for clarity, in other words, there would be absolutely no doubt as to the standing of those people who would be put 100% out of work by the ending of the exporting of natural gas. You wouldn't have to say, well, we don't know. No one's actually been harmed yet. You could see, you know, even the Supreme Court could recognize the standing of the people.
Right. I think so. And it's pretty clear. So we represent the Oil and Gas Workers Association. They have over, I think, 40,000 workers in their association from various states, a number of which are from Louisiana. Hmm. I think that's closer to like 28,000 in Louisiana. So these people, there are a lot that would absolutely be affected by a complete ban on LNG exports. So what happened recently is that the court issued a preliminary injunction in the case against, or that the states brought against the Biden administration. And so that basically means that the federal government cannot enforce this ban on LNG exports. So they put a pause and the court said, no, you can't pause it. And so in other words, the status quo that's been in place for the past 40 years has to stay in place until the judge makes a final ruling on this. But this is good news because that means business can continue to move forward until we get a final decision. And based on the judge's 62-page opinion and what was said during the oral arguments, I think it's pretty clear that this was exceeds their statutory authority. It violated the separation of powers. They ignored the Administrative Procedures Act. Hmm. So it was pretty illegal.
Yeah, that's exactly what the issue was in Cargill. It wasn't a Second mm-hmm. Amendment. It was the fact that the ATF just didn't have the authority. They ignored Administrative Procedures Act, and that's what the Supreme Court pretty much said, a pretty definitive decision on that. And I imagine that will have some sway on your client, the natural gas workers, that decision, will it not?
Yes, I think so. There's been a number of decisions that the Supreme Court issued this term that really affect the administrative agencies, mm-hmm. and it really reins in their authority because they have gotten out of control in the past year.
Oh, have they ever? Speaking of which, well, that's been the case since the Kansas wheat decision, the name of which I can't remember from the 30s, but you know which one I'm talking about, right?
I think so.
Wickard v. Filburn, I think, is that one.
Yes.
What does the recent Loper-Bright versus Raimondo decision from the Supreme Court portend for your case in terms of Chevron deference?
Well, so Chevron deference, for those who don't know, also came out around the early 80s. And basically it was a judicial decision by the Supreme Court that said that when there's an ambiguity in the statute and the agency makes a rule, and hey, of course, you're going to follow this kind of two-step analysis when deciding, you know, is it ambiguous? You know, could it possibly be within the realm of authority? You're just going to defer to the agency. And so what it has happened over the past 40 years is that most agency decisions, even when the statute isn't ambiguous, most agency challenges to agency decisions end up being in favor of the agency because the court will often just hang their hat on Chevron and go, well, Chevron deference, and kind of throw their arms up. So it is a big decision that I think will affect a lot of agencies. And this one, I think we're going to feel even sooner, you know, in the next few months and in the coming years, because it's going to affect a lot of the rules. And it won't be an automatic thing. So you still have to challenge the rule and say, hey, you've exceeded your statutory authority, or you've exceeded your constitutional authority. You know, and you have to have some basis to challenge the rule. But now, instead of the court just automatically deferring to the agency and say, well, they made the rule, they know better, it's fine, now the courts will actually have to do the analysis and decide, did it really exceed the authority? Did it really exceed the constitutional authority? So I do think this is important. Now, granted, this is a weird one because they didn't even follow the Administrative Procedures Act and create a rule. So I guess the argument there would be, if the court decides somehow that this is a rule, they shouldn't be deferring to the agency. So it would still help us. And the trend with the Supreme Court definitely seems to be reining in the administrative agencies.
Well, hallelujah. Let freedom ring. So this doesn't mean we don't want government, or we don't want any, or government doesn't have authority to regulate in certain areas. It just means they can't exceed that authority, or as I like to say, that government remains servant, not master. That's my words, not the Liberty Justice Center's. But do you see a trend line going in the direction of eventually reversing things like Wickard v. Filburn, where if it even if it affects interstate commerce, that it reins in the authority of agencies to do this regulation, this type of regulation?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say just now that the trend is towards overruling Wickard. You know, I haven't looked at that case in quite a while.
That's more of a law school question. I'm sorry. I don't mean to. I don't bring anybody on here to run them up on the rocks. But I am.
No. But it's basically dealing with interstate commerce and economic effect. And so Congress does have the authority to regulate commerce.
Yeah, interstate commerce. Right.
And foreign commerce. Mm-hmm. So that is within Congress's authority.
Is the problem here that the agency is doing more than Congress has allowed them to do? Is that the true problem?
Yes. So agencies fall under the executive branch, but the Constitution only established three branches. And our agencies have become so powerful and so influential that they, in effect, feel like a fourth branch of the government, unelected officials that are simply appointed by the executive branch. And the executive branch's responsibility is to enforce the law that Congress creates. Now, granted, we've got to go way back because we have the Administrative Procedures Act that was put in place to act as it really was a constitutional protection to provide some due process thresholds or safeguards for this administrative agency, because they have rulemaking authority and adjudicatory authority. So whether or not there's some potential challenges down the road to should the administrative agencies even have the authority to adjudicate, I think that's a fair question that may be challenged somewhere down the road. I think we're a little ways away from that, but I think there's a potential argument there that perhaps they do not have the constitutional authority to do so.
There was a recent case in the Supreme Court that had to do with administrative law courts, and I was listening to it on American Radio Journal this morning before I drove into the station, and it's going to have some effect, and I didn't hear 100% what it was, but it's going to have some effect on the ability to use administrative law courts to impose fines, because in that case of the administrative law courts, you have judges that actually work for the agency that's fining you, not an independent judge in an Article 3, the Constitution, Article 3 of the Constitution court. And I wonder how much that's going to have to do with this.
So was that the SEC versus Jarkissi case?
Yes.
Yes. So I actually wrote amicus briefs in both the SEC versus Jarkissi and the Loper-Bright case. And the SEC versus Jarkissi case, that was an important decision, but it hinged on the right to a jury trial.
Right.
And that when you went through an administrative judge, you didn't get a jury trial. So it still left open, you know, the question of this delegation. You know, was the delegation to administrative agencies proper? I still think there's that question, because I still think that, you know, delegating even rulemaking and adjudicatory authority to the agencies, I think is arguably unconstitutional because they're supposed to be enforcement branches. They're not supposed to be judge, jury, prosecutor, and that's what they're acting as. They issue the fine, and then they say, well, we'll hire someone. But, of course, the person that's hired is paid by the agency.
See, right, yeah.
And then, lo and behold, most of the time it goes in the agency's way.
Yep.
And then the board of whatever agency will say, well, we'll review the decision. And they go, well, you know what? We agree. This decision goes our way, of course.
Yeah. Show me the man and I'll show you the crime. We're at the bottom of the hour. Can you stay past the bottom of the hour, or do you have to go?
I could stay.
All right, because there's still a lot more meat left on this bone, and I would love to go through it with you. And when you mention a case and the lawyer says, yeah, I wrote the amici on that, that's a vein of gold, Lauren. I really appreciate that. All right, stand by.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening to Liberty Watch with Charles Heller, Tucson, Arizona.
This is Herman Cain. You get some good bargains on the Swap Shop on AM 1030, KVOI, The Voice. and have Charles make fun of your stuff.
I click clack my bills, they have my fill. I'm a gigantic pelican. I fly.
And welcome back to Liberty Watch, where we have the joy and pleasure of having with us Lauren C. Hayes. She's with the Liberty Justice Center, and they, along with the Pelican Institute, which is why I keep making Pelican references, along with the Pelican Institute out of Louisiana, have filed suit against the Biden administration for the stopping, for this pausing of the shipments, international shipments of liquefied natural gas. How big is the scope of the shipping of liquefied natural gas across the world, Lauren?
Oh, that is probably not a number I have off the top of my
head. That's okay.
But
you're
I
a lawyer.
In...
You're a lawyer, not an energy specialist. But I mean, are we talking billions of dollars? Are we talking millions of dollars? Do you know?
Easily millions, if not billions.
Okay, so we're talking a large number of commerce that's just basically, if the permits don't get approved, that are just going to absolutely grind to a halt a portion of the United States economy. How many workers are we talking about that this affects?
Well, our client represents, they're an association, a trade association that has over 44,000 members. And so that's just one association. I know there's a number of other ones that also have thousands of members. And I'm sure there's some overlap between the groups, but we are talking tens of thousands of American workers that could be potentially without a job.
Do you have any sense of whether a lot of them are unionized?
You know,
it's okay if you don't know.
I wouldn't know how many are unionized.
It strikes me that the unions might actually be a natural ally in this. And you start having the unions lean on former Vice President Biden, and he actually might listen to that. Well, assuming he's assuming that that you catch him in the right hour of the day to have a cogent thought.
Yeah, I think it's only between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m.
Yeah, after that, it's, what do they call it, sundowning? Oh, well, that's okay. Listen, we'll just have our enemies attack us in those hours, and we'll be fine. I'm sure it'll be all be fine.
It'll be fine. Nothing happens after 4 p.m.
Right, no. Well, nothing good. The court in Louisiana, as you mentioned earlier, has granted an injunction to stop the current administration's activity to halt LNG shipments. Usually they don't grant an injunction unless they think you have a pretty good possibility of winning the case. Is that correct?
Right. So when you have an injunction, so what happens is the party who's usually the one bringing the lawsuit files what's called a motion for preliminary injunction, basically asking the court to keep the status quo, just keep it as it is during the pendency of this litigation until you rule on the final ruling on the merits. And so that's what the states have brought in this particular case. And so this motion for preliminary injunction, the standard that the Supreme Court has set for us is like a four-prong standard. And the biggest prong is that there is a likelihood of success on the merits.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, you have to make your arguments to the court and say, look, we've got all of these facts, this information, here's the law, here's cases, here's analysis, and here's why we would win. And so it's not the court saying, yes, you've won, but the court goes, you know, it's more likely than not that you will win. So winning a preliminary injunction is a good thing. Obviously, you know, in this case, it pauses the LNG export ban, but it also signals to the plaintiffs, and in our case as well, that there's a likelihood that we're going to win on the merits. And so oftentimes, unless there's extenuating circumstances or facts that weren't in evidence before, most of the times the court is going to end up ruling the same way that they ruled on their preliminary injunction because they've already gone through the analysis.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that the current administration, if this goes against them at the trial court level, will cry uncle and give up? Or do you think they'll appeal this?
Well, I don't think this administration often cries uncle and gives up, even when it's obvious that they're wrong on the law. And they have no qualms, it appears, to be to violate the separation of powers and exceed their statutory authority and the constitutional authority, and even just completely ignore the law that is written and do their own thing. And then they'll double down on it and appeal it. So I don't think they'll give up anytime soon.
Their view, it appears, the separation of powers is what separation. So hang on, we got a caller coming in. I want to go ahead and answer that in the blind. Caller, your first name, please.
Chris.
Chris, go ahead. Ask your question for Lauren Cihes.
Great topic. Great show, Lauren. I've actually been researching this. I never thought researching about banning natural gas would just open up so much information. I've been looking at the Department of Energy and how they've gone after natural gas over the last 3 years, to where they've literally made the efficiency of the water heaters where you can only use one of the instantaneous hot water heaters. And if your house can't hook up to it, you must use electricity. And then I just started reading about the city of Berkeley. I'm assuming it's California, where they actually tried to ban gas pipes, and not even ban natural gas, but the conveyance of it. And just all of these just they're pretty much tyrannical things that they're doing. And if you want hope, go to handsoffmystove.com to where local grassroots have beat back on it, and it gives you hope. But great topic. And then I wanted to get your opinion on, do you really think they're going to get it banned? Because 2029...
Appreciate it, Chris. Do you really think they're going to get it banned? Lauren Cihes, hit it out of the park.
I hope not. I think that we have a lot of natural gas that should be exported. That's more my personal opinion. But I don't think so. Unless Congress changes the law that bans liquid natural gas, I don't think that they're going to do it. And, you know, hopefully there's a shift.
Everyone who listens to any commercial on the radio always has a question in their head. What's in this for me? Why should I keep listening? Why should this issue of the shipment of liquefied natural gas throughout the world from the United States matter to the listeners of this program? We're down to the last 2 minutes.
Well, I think it has a big impact. One, it has an impact on our economy. So we're talking tens of thousands of American workers that rely on this entire economy. It's an entire industry. So they rely on that for their income, but it also, the companies that are exporting liquid natural gases are also pumping money into the American economy by making deals to export the gas to these foreign countries. It's also good for the world economy to keep things moving. And if you want to look at it from an environmental perspective, liquid natural gas is, even in the court's order, said it was undisputed that it was cleaner than other fossil fuels. So it's better for our environment, and it's better for our economy.
Mm-hmm. And where do we get more information on this case, and how do we participate in it with you, either financially or in some other way?
Absolutely. So you can go to libertyjusticecenter.org. And you can read about all of our different cases across the country, not just on liquid natural gas, but all various aspects of the Constitution, workers' rights, freedom of speech, even some Second Amendment cases, and government overreach just generally. So that's where you can get that information, and if you feel so inclined to give donations to.
Yep. This is public interest law. They don't make a profit on this stuff, folks. They just keep suing the government when the government tries to become master, not servant. Lauren Cihes, thank you so much for your time in the extra segment. This has been fascinating.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
My pleasure. I'm always open to LJC guests, and Chris Berger can send me anybody he wants, even if it's a little off topic, and I'll probably consider it because he knows how to do publicity, and I don't speak super highly of the publicity industry very often, so he motivates me. All right, you have a blessed day.
Wonderful. Thanks, you too.
Bye. And we'll be back with a little bit of interesting stuff in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios. I got something from the Babylon Bee, which is just fascinating. Back after this.
This is Dennis Weaver, and you're listening to Liberty Watch. You know, the exchange of ideas is so important to maintain our freedom in this country. And Liberty Watch is a show that promotes freedom.
Listen to Inside Track, Saturdays, 1 on KDOI, The Voice.
Hartman Glass invites you to its Gallery of Glass showroom for custom shower doors, tables, and glass enclosures. From boardrooms to an exquisite display case for your valued collectibles, need a glass conference room in your office? Laser measuring for accuracy. 903-0766 and see them online at hartman-glass.com. That's hartman-glass.com.
It's not my tights that cut off circulation. Big business wants to control the net nation. What you can see, how much you should pay. Tell me, is this the democratic way?
I'm the internet, you're the internet, we're the internet, now that's the internet. I like the net, we love the net, and I can prove it. I'm the internet, you're the internet, we're the internet, now that's the internet. I like the net, we love the net.
And I want to talk a little bit about the internet and freedom thereon. In this segment, I want to talk about making a difference. Some people think that if they stay below the radar, they won't get shot down in quotes. Well, let's take a look at what Reverend Niermüller, Pastor Niermüller said about that. And most of you know what I'm about to say in this quote. And it's that, at first, they came for the trade unionists, and I wasn't a trade unionist, so I didn't say anything. And then they came for the, Jews, and I wasn't a Jew, so they didn't, so, I didn't say anything. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to say anything. And that's kind of how we are about not standing up. If we don't stand up, and by standing up, I don't mean doing anything physically forceful against government. I mean joining with people like Liberty Justice Center, sending them a few bucks, and helping them sue the government when the government does things that are beyond its authority. That's what I mean by that. And specifically, when hotheads want to do something that's not lawful or stand up by themselves, you back away from them. And the reason for that is it ends up with bad case law when a person challenges the government individually, and they end up with bad case law named after them. I give you Miller versus U.S. from 1939. That's what happens when one person stands up to government. And it's not a definitive case as an example, but it is an example of one person standing up. What you need is an organization, you need a group, you need a front that confronts government lawfully when it's doing wrong and uses lawful process, bends their tailpipe and sticks it down their intake into their carburetor and make them choke out on their own gases when they're doing things wrong. And that's how you need to fight. Now, I have a clip here from Seth Dillon of the Babylon Bee talking about what happens when even one person stands up and fights. And so I am going to turn this up, and we will see. This is about 7.5 minutes from the owner of the Babylon Bee.
Not long ago, Elon Musk bought Twitter, changed his bio to Chief Twit, and sent me a DM that said, "Do you want the Babylon Bee restored? There will be no censorship of humor." We've been trying to think of a joke worth $44 billion ever since. But as resourceful and committed to free speech as he is, Musk is still just one man. And Twitter, now X, is just one platform. Censorship remains the rule on big tech. X is a welcome but rare exception. Just a couple of months ago, I was notified that the David Horowitz Freedom Center, a conservative nonprofit, was permanently suspended by Vimeo for posting a talk I'd given about censorship. Just think about the irony of that for a second. As if they wanted to make my point for me more emphatically than I ever could, they censored my talk about censorship. Why? Hate speech, they said. I was giving a talk about how the Bee had been censored unjustly for hate speech, and they censored it for hate speech. We've reached a point where you can't even talk about how they're censoring you without them censoring you. I think Dave Chappelle was right when he said, "It shouldn't be this dangerous to talk." So what is it exactly that the lovers of censorship want from us? I think the answer is clear. They want acquiescence. They want submission. They want unquestioning conformity. They want us to give up and stop fighting, stop telling jokes, stop telling the truth. They want to raise the cost of speaking freely so high that we'd rather just keep our mouths shut to avoid all the hassle and penalties. And that would be the easy thing, wouldn't it? Adjust our behavior, fall in line, do our best to play by the rules of wokeness that try to reshape reality itself. It'd certainly be easier than fighting back and risking everything. We'd have no more headaches, no more suspensions, no more disruptions to our revenue streams. And all it would cost us is our integrity. All we'd have to trade for a little peace of mind in a platform is the truth itself and our right to speak it. All we have to do is trade freedom, a thing so profoundly valuable that men have laid down their lives to secure it, for captivity and capitulation. Are you willing to make that trade just to make things easier? We were faced with this choice when Twitter suspended us last year for a joke we made about Rachel Levine, a transgender health admiral in the Biden administration. For those who don't remember the details, USA Today had named Rachel Levine their pick for Woman of the Year. Apparently, they'd run out of real women to choose from. And we looked at that headline, and it felt like a parody already. How are you supposed to satirize something like that? You got a man in a dress picked for Woman of the Year. It sounds like something straight out of a South Park episode. But that's the burden of being in comedy today. You have to somehow manage to come up with jokes that are funnier than whatever Democrats are doing in real life. It's a tough job. So we started pitching ideas back and forth, and one we had was just to mock USA Today's insane choice for Woman of the Year by just accurately referring to Rachel Levine as a man. The headline we landed on was this: the Babylon Bee's Man of the Year is Rachel Levine. Our chief editor, Kyle, joked that this one was going to get us kicked off Twitter. They count on this, by the way. They know that if they can make you afraid of being deplatformed, you'll do their job for them and censor yourself. For every case of hard censorship where they actually take down user content, there are 1,000 cases of soft censorship where users bite their own tongue knowing they'll be penalized if they speak freely. But we don't do that here. We refuse to censor ourselves. So we took a chance and posted the Rachel Levine joke, knowing it might get us in some trouble. It wasn't long, of course, before some trans activists got a hold of it and started mass reporting the tweet. Twitter reviewed it, determined we'd violated the hateful conduct policy, which prohibits misgendering, and they sent us a notice to say that we'd been locked out of our account. As these platforms often do, they gave us a choice. Delete the tweet, and you can have your account back. Refuse, and your account will remain locked indefinitely. Now, they could have deleted it themselves. That would have been censorship, sure, but I'd much prefer that to what actually happened. Instead of deleting it themselves, they told us we had to delete it. And not only that, we had to check a box acknowledging that we'd engaged in hateful conduct. That's not just censorship. It's subjugation. So we refused. Within minutes, I responded publicly. "We're not deleting anything," I tweeted. "If the cost of speaking the truth is the loss of our Twitter account, then so be it." We knew this meant losing access to our millions of followers. We knew it meant being sidelined from the conversation. But we also knew we'd be giving up something even more important if we caved. Almost immediately, people started mocking us and taunting us, saying it was only a matter of time before we deleted the tweet. They couldn't wait to see us betray our own principles just to get back the clicks and engagement we'd given up. I actually found their wishing we'd show weakness motivational. It made me want to double down. I mean, what could be more fun than disappointing a bunch of leftists? A couple of days later, we got a call from Elon Musk. He wanted to know if we'd actually been suspended. And we explained that we were locked out and had to delete a tweet in order to get our account back. He asked us why that was a problem for us, so we gave our reasons, and he respected them. Then he pauses for a moment, and he says, "Maybe I just need to buy Twitter." We thought he was kidding. Apparently, he wasn't. But Musk understands the dangers of censorship. He knows that the freedom to argue and tell jokes is necessary, not just for the entertainment value, but because bad ideas need to be challenged. They need to be refuted, and they need to be ridiculed, or they'll spread like the mind viruses that they are and ruin everything. Chief among the mind viruses is wokeness. Musk has called it one of the greatest threats to civilization and cited its spread as one of the primary reasons he felt compelled to buy Twitter. I asked him why he thinks wokeness is such a threat, and this was his reply. "Wokeness, at its heart, is divisive, exclusionary, and hateful. It gives mean people an excuse to be cruel while armored in false virtue." That's beautifully put, but more importantly, it's true. And we're seeing this play out with the left's attacks on comedy. Mean people, I like to call them crybullies, want to take away our freedom to tell jokes, and they're doing it in the name of protecting others from harm. But they aren't actually protecting anyone. All they're doing is shielding their bad ideas from criticism and mockery. Just like Musk said, wokeness is oppressive cruelty designed to crush dissent, all under the guise of false virtue. And they'll tell you that we're using the cover of satire to push hatred. But that's just projection. In reality, they're using the power of concern for the so-called marginalized to be bullies and tyrants who trample all over our freedom. We saw this play out with the recent advertiser boycott of X. Big brands like Disney, Apple, and IBM were withdrawing their ad spend in an effort to twist Musk's arm and get him to do their bidding. They thought they could raise the price of speaking freely so high that even Elon Musk wouldn't be willing to pay it. They were wrong. It turns out there are things that matter more than money to people with integrity. The bullies and tyrants have forgotten that. I'm sure most of you have seen the video where Musk told them not to advertise. Using language I won't repeat here, he told them he didn't want their money if it came with strings attached, strings that infringed on the freedom of both himself and the millions of users he'd just liberated. I don't think people realize how profound it is to see somebody stand up and say, "You can't bully me into silence and force me to do whatever you want by holding money over my head. Free speech is worth more than whatever you might try to take from me." No one's ever stood up to Disney like that before and said no thanks to their mountain of money. It was insane. It was inspirational. And there's an important lesson in it. Musk has shown us the key to winning this fight. We have to stop caring what freedom might cost us. Of course, that's easier said than done. When you're the world's richest man, you can suffer some pretty heavy losses without having to move back in with your parents. But what about the rest of us? I can tell you right now, the Babylon Bee would not have been able to take the stand that we did against Twitter if it hadn't been for the support of our subscribers. That's our safety net. That's what gives us confidence to fight back against big tech without having to fear they'll put us out of business. They can hurt us, sure. They can reduce our reach and smear us in the media. But they can't shut us down. We have our supporters to thank for that. I hope you'll consider joining the fight by becoming a paid subscriber to the Babylon Bee. But don't just support us. Support defenders of freedom wherever you find them. Subscribe to X Premium to support Elon. Ditch Disney and subscribe to the Daily Wire. Back anyone bold enough to say what's true, even if it comes at a cost. Especially if it comes at a cost. They'll be that much more fearless and that much harder to stop if they have a whole army of freedom-loving subscribers at their back.
And therein lies my point. And he said it better. The Seth Dillon of the Babylon Bee said it better than I could have, which is, for crying out loud, pick out an area that is motivational to you. Find an area, whatever that area is, and work in the progressive realization of more and more freedom, the way the country was designed to work based on what you believe in. If you're not willing to do that, then just speaking about it is ineffective. In Shakespeare, I think it's in Macbeth, he hath a killing tongue but a quiet sword. Don't do that. And I don't mean literally a sword. I mean your sword is your checkbook. Your sword is your own physical labor to go out and work for a candidate. And if you can't physically do that, I understand there's a lot of people who can't do that, who aren't up to going out and knocking on a door. But do something. Become a poll watcher. Become a volunteer. Go with an organization that you believe in and do some kind of volunteer work for them, whatever it happens to be. Somewhere, there is a place where you can express your activism towards freedom in a positive way that doesn't damage anybody, that helps freedom. If you keep your head down and you hunker down and you do nothing thinking that they'll get you last, I promise you there will be no one left for you to act, to help you when it comes time for your activism. AM 1030, KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, The Voice. Stay tuned for America Armed and Free.